Hey, Michael Steele podcast listeners, Michael Steele here with another quick take from the Michael Steele podcast. Check out what's going on right now.
Welcome back, everybody, to Michael Steele podcast. We are having a great conversation with Professor Carol Anderson, the Charles Howard Candler Professor of African American Studies at Emory University, and the author of three important books. And we're talking about each of them, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Nation's Divide. One Person, One Vote, No Vote. One Person, No Vote. How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. And now we're going to turn our attention to her latest book called The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. So I'm just going to let you start us off on that one, because I just love the title. There is, as you know, roughly 300 and almost 400 million guns in spread out across America. And we're only a country of about 325 million people. So Houston, we got a problem.
We got a problem. We got a problem. And
I say that as someone who is supportive of the Second Amendment and all that it means, but I ain't crazy. But I'll turn it over to the professor. Go ahead.
So what started me on this book was the killing of Philando Castile.
Mm.
Because here you had a Black man in Minnesota who was pulled over by the police.
Right.
And he asked to see his ID. And so Philando Castile, following NRA guidelines, alerts the police officer that he has a license to carry weapon, but he is reaching for his ID so that the police officer isn't surprised when he sees a gun.
Right.
The cop hears, you got a gun, and the police officer starts shooting. 5 bullets. Kills Philando Castile with a child sitting in the back seat. Lord have mercy.
Yeah.
And the NRA, this guardian of the Second Amendment, goes virtually silent. Because here we have a Black man who is shot for merely having a gun. Not for brandishing a weapon, not right. for threatening somebody with a weapon, but for merely having a legally licensed to carry gun.
Right.
And so it took the Black members of the NRA to push the NRA to make a statement. And the NRA says something to the effect of, well, we believe that everybody should have the right to bear arms. Now, this is the same NRA after Ruby Ridge in Waco.
Right.
Call federal law enforcement jackbooted government thugs.
Yep.
But goes virtually, it bees that way sometimes when it comes to a Black man getting killed. And so you had pundits asking, well, don't Black people have Second Amendment rights? And for all of my work, because I have 2 other books before these 3, Eyes Off the Prize and Bourgeois Radicals. And all of them, I'm looking at the rights of African Americans. I had never explored the right to bear arms, the Second Amendment. And so I went hunting and I ended up back in the 17th century. Whoo.
Do we need to go get a drink real quick?
Yes. Yes, Lord, call his name. And there I saw this incredible fear of Black people and the laws emanating out of that fear of the enslaved and the fear of free Blacks as well, that they were dangerous. They were a threat to the white community, to the safety of the white community. And so you saw these series of laws coming in talking about thou shalt not bear arms. Black folks cannot have weapons.
Right.
They cannot have guns. They cannot have ammunition. They cannot. And you see this coming through. And so I'm following this all the way. Actually, I'm following it all the way up to Kyle Rittenhouse, but in the book. But what I see coming in with the Second Amendment itself is that when the Constitution was being ratified and they're going from state to state for this ratification convention, they hit Virginia. And Virginia's like, nah, son, nah, son, nah, son. And it was Patrick Henry and George Mason.
Right.
And they were angry, 8 ways to Sunday, angry at James Madison for putting control of the militia in the Constitution under the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And he did that because despite the narratives that we have, the militias were not reliable when it came to dealing with a professional army. This foreign invasion, when it came to the British, sometimes they show up.
Sometimes they don't. I'm sorry, I got to go find my cows.
Right, you know, sometimes they fight. Sometimes they take off running. George was like, dang, what's a general to do? And then there was Shay's Rebellion, which happened in Massachusetts, where you had anger at the Massachusetts government for taxation policy. So the Shay's Rebellion, these farmers were attacking the Massachusetts government. Massachusetts government calls out the militia. The militia's like, nah, I don't think we're going to fight them. In fact, you had some members of the militia joining Shay's Rebellion. So Boston merchants had to hire a mercenary army to put down Shay's Rebellion. So the thinking of James Madison was that we need to get this thing organized, regular, you know, regulated to get them up to snuff, get them up to standards.
Right.
Patrick Henry and George Mason, who are large slave owners, looked at that and went, oh, no. You know, when you've got it under the federal government, that means that you've got Massachusetts and Pennsylvania weighing in on whether they're going to send the militia down when we have our slaves revolt. We will be left defenseless. We're not having that. We are not having that. And so they were threatening to scuttle the Constitution. But what the agreement was that there would be a Bill of Rights put in the Constitution. These amendments that would curtail the power of the federal government. And so when you think about it, you think about freedom of speech, the right not to be illegally searched and seized, the right to a speedy, fair trial, the right not to have cruel and unusual punishment, the right to a well-regulated militia for the security of a free state. That thing is an outlier. It is the same kind of outlier that the three-fifths clause is in the Constitution. It is the bribe to the South to not scuttle the United States of America. It is the bribe to say, hey, we got this. You got this. You want your slavery? You got it. We're cool with that. The United States of America is too important as an entity to have it disrupted on the shoals of slavery. So the extortion, they extorted the Second Amendment because the militia, what the militia could really do, so they couldn't fight off a professional army.
Right.
You couldn't count on them in terms of these kinds of uprisings of whites against the white government. But you could count on that militia to put down a slave revolt.
Interesting.
So the curtailing of Black folks' humanity, the curtailing of Black folks' rights is embedded in that Second Amendment.
Around that discussion, what was the consideration for these individuals in the first instance? So was the matter of the South looking at chattel property and how they protect that property against a Northern aggression, you know, under certain circumstances. But ultimately that's what happened, right?
So the South looked at it as that you couldn't trust the North to protect slavery because you already had several of these states who had put in these sunset clauses because we had slavery in all 13
colonies.
That's right. Yeah. But several of these states had put in sunset clauses on slavery. And this is what was creating the consternation in Virginia. And remember, Virginia was a big, powerful state at that time. Just, you know, it was one of the big dogs. And so when Virginia is barking loud and hard, no, and threatening to have a new constitutional convention unless they got the protections that they needed. Madison is in that Virginia ratification convention. Madison is going, look, you already got the three-fifths clause. Look, you already got the 20 extra years of the Atlantic slave trade. You've already got the fugitive slave clause. Slavery is protected in the Constitution. And Patrick Henry was not enough. Not enough.
Interesting. What? Why? How did? I mean, it's a little bit of a sidebar, but I think it kind of goes to the core of what you're talking about in the second about the connection between race and guns in this country. Why did the how did we get to the point that this became something that was so essential to the South, but not essential to the North? This sort of dividing line between free states and slave states, North and South. I get it, 1619, the whole process and how that sort of evolves. But when you get to the late 1700s, and the sort of formation of government and the founding of this republic, is it because slavery had become such an economic engine for the South to the point that the humanity of the individuals didn't matter anymore? Or I'm just so people can kind of understand how something so horrid was able to really not just stain, but indelibly stain the United States.
And so you had this fusion of tapping into religion to justify the unjustifiable, to make slavery appear to be God ordained, because these were heathens, because these were savages, because of the curse of Ham, that this is their place, this is their natural status. Once you have it God ordained, and then you have the economics rolling out of this, by the time we got to the Civil War, slavery accounted for about 80% of the nation's GNP. I mean, it was just a massive economic engine. And for the North also gained lots of resources off of slavery, from the banking that the slavery required.
Yeah, okay.
To the shipping that slavery required. The North also got a lot of resources off of this. But part of what happened, and this is the piece that I wrote in The Guardian about the danger of white supremacy, is not just its existence, but that it is never held accountable for the damage that it does to American society, to American democracy. And white supremacy cannot be sated. You can't appease it. It always wants more. And this is what was happening with the South. So the South gets this fugitive slave clause, the Atlantic slave trade, the three-fifths clause, and the Second Amendment. And they're like, cool. So as you expand North, as you expand West, we want slavery to expand West. And the North is like,
no, that's not happening.
And you get this where, you know, Joanne Freeman has this wonderful book, Field of Blood, where she talks about the ways that Southern congressmen would physically beat on Northern congressmen and Northern senators over the issues of slavery to stop slavery from even being discussed in Congress. When we get to the 1850 Fugitive Slave Law, Slave Act, the North was like, okay, we're done. We are done appeasing you. We are finished appeasing you. There's not enough appeasement that will satisfy you. You want it all.
Mm-hmm.
And this becomes the kind of break that we see where the North was like, okay.
That eventually led to the Civil War.
Yes, yes.
So you note in the second, measures to expand and curtail gun ownership aimed disproportionately at the African-American population. The right to bear arms has been consistently used as a weapon to keep African-Americans powerless, revealing that armed and or unarmed Blackness, it would seem, is the threat that must be neutralized and punished. Is that still the order of the day in your view?
Yes. Yes. I mean, it is. Think about how many times. Think about how many times you have heard about somebody Black being gunned down who was unarmed.
Mm-hmm.
But the word is, we feared. He was a threat. He was dangerous. So I think about, for instance, Jonathan Farrell, who was a Black man in North Carolina who got into a car accident. He got out of his car. He knocked on the door. A woman was afraid. You know, she sees a Black guy there, so she calls the cops. When the cops show up, he thinks, oh, great, the cops are here to help me because I've been in an accident. As he's walking towards them, they start shooting. And the language is, we were afraid. Think about Tamir Rice, who is the 12-year-old boy in Cleveland who was playing alone. And Ohio is an open carry state, playing alone in a park with a toy gun. And granted, the orange tip wasn't on this toy gun that said, hey, I'm a toy. Mm-hmm. But Ohio is an open carry state. And it says, the law says, as long as you're not pointing the gun at anybody, as long as you're not threatening anybody, you can open carry. So he's in a park by himself playing. The cops roll up and within 2 seconds, they shoot him. And they say, we were afraid. He was a threat. He was dangerous. Now, juxtapose that to Kyle Rittenhouse.
Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for listening today. Please go to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star review. Heck, give us 2 5-star reviews. I love it. Or catch us on Stitcher, iHeart, TuneIn, or wherever you get that podcast thing on. You know how that goes. Peace out.
All right, America. You asked for it. Or maybe you didn't, but either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So, we are going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Listen to Facepalm America, a podcast that laughs at America and its politics, from Beowulf Rocklin, producer of The Rick Unger Show. Facepalm America, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, and wherever you download your digital distractions in audio form.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.